Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
When I tell people I am interested in the songs in the hymnal that we don't sing, they say, "No more auction block for me." This is the story of that song. In 1861, early in the Civil War, the Confederate forces began to design and construct forts to defend Port Royal Sound in coastal South Carolina. This is not their story. This story comes not from the war rooms or state houses, but from the boats crossing Port Royal Sound. The boats were rowed by enslaved men. They had been requisitioned away from the nearby Sea Island plantations. The plantation owners begrudgingly allowed the army to take the men they viewed as their property. This is the story of the men who rowed the boats to build the forts that defended other men's claim to own them. And happily, we have the story in their own words. "No more peck of corn for me. No more, no more. No more peck of corn for me, many thousand go." And the verses go on, "No more driver's lash for me. No more pint of salt for me. No more hundred lash for me. No more mistress call for me." We have these words because Union Colonel Thomas Wentworth Higginson wrote them down in his journal. He explains that the peck of corn and pint of salt were the rations of slavery. A Lieutenant Colonel Trowbridge provided the information that the song dated from the requisition of the enslaved men. They rowed the boats and labored to build the forts that would protect the institution of slavery. Either the Confederate forces had too little time to complete their defenses, or their labor force proved unwilling to build forts for their own enslavement. The forts were not finished before the Union forces attacked, and the captured slaves were right. Slavery was over, at least for them. They were effectively free from that moment. No more pint of salt, no more peck of corn, no more driver's lash. As I said, this is their story. It's important that we know it, and it's important that we know why we know it. When the Union forces captured Port Royal Sound, they found themselves in the custody of the nearly 10,000 men, women, and children who had been enslaved just on the Sea Island plantations. Abolitionists in the North, anticipating that further victories would deliver freedom to millions of enslaved people, turned their thoughts to Port Royal. The newly freed people living in the area would need help transitioning to free life. In the immediate moment, they needed food and something to do. To prepare for free life, they needed an education. The abolitionists also viewed the Port Royal experiment, as it became known, as an opportunity to showcase the humanity and potential of the newly freed people and all those of the African race. Missionaries descended on Port Royal, many of them Unitarians and Quakers. William Francis Allen, chose to work as a teacher to the freedmen of St. Helena's Island rather than serve in the army. He was a pedigreed Boston Unitarian, son of the Reverend Joseph Allen and Lucy Clark Ware. Allen and his wife Mary taught children and adults basic reading, arithmetic, and geography. He was a classics scholar and an amateur musician, and he studied the language and music of the freedmen in South Carolina. Allen's cousin, Charles Picard Ware, and Ware's wife Harriet also went to St. Helena's. Charlie Ware was the superintendent of the cotton plantation at Coffin Point. This son of Massachusetts did not know how to grow cotton. So he learned from the former slaves who had been responsible for the crop all along. Harriet Ware was a school teacher at Coffin Point. 19-year-old Lucy McKim visited Port Royal with her father. They were Philadelphia abolitionists of Quaker heritage. They were on a philanthropic mission, delivering donations and collecting information to bring back to the donors. They stayed only 1 month. Confederate forces conducted raids on the islands, and James McKim feared for his teenage daughter's safety. Lucy McKim, after her return to Philadelphia, sang the songs she had heard the freedmen sing at the abolitionist meetings where her father raised funds and recruited teachers to send to the South. One more, and this name may be familiar to you. Thomas Wentworth Higginson was a militant abolitionist and radical Unitarian minister. Like his colleague Theodore Parker, his commitment to abolitionism and women's rights had cost him his pulpit, and he made his living publishing essays wherever he could. During the Civil War, he was offered a position as colonel over the 1st Regiment of Emancipated Slaves quartered in the Port Royal area. Higginson kept a journal of his service, and after the war, published essays about this time in the Atlantic Monthly. These essays were published in 1870 as a book, Army Life in a Black Regiment. Higginson's essay, Negro Spirituals, which appeared in the June 1867 issue of the Atlantic Monthly, featured 37 songs collected during his time with the regiment. Higginson was the one who recorded Many Thousand Go and the letter from Emma Stewart to her husband, one of the many black soldiers in his regiment. Back in Philadelphia, Lucy McKim arranged and published two of the freedmen's songs as sheet music. The Civil War ended. She married Wendell Garrison, one of the founders of the new magazine, The Nation. But the songs still had a hold on her. She wrote to her connections in South Carolina, the teachers and missionaries for whom her family had raised funds, asking them for more slave songs. Garrison wrote to his connections, the literary set in New York, New England, and Philadelphia. Garrison recruited William Allen. Allen recruited his cousin, Charlie Ware. Garrison put out a general call for songs as an ad in the magazine. And Allen edited the collection into a musical anthropological record. The collection was published as Slave Songs of the United States in November 1867. Those who are familiar with the freedmen communities in the South remarked that since the contributors' arrival in Port Royal and the freedmen's ongoing interaction with people from outside plantation culture, the songs were already heard less than they had been. Charlotte Fortin published a review of the volume in the December 1867 issue of the Freedman's Record that draws upon her own experience of St. Helena's Island. We are very glad that these songs, which are too rapidly losing favor among the freedmen, are thus collected and preserved, for they make a most striking, curious, and valuable addition to the history of slavery in this country. An anonymous review in The Nation, almost certainly written by Lucy McKim Garrison herself, contains the wishes that the songs become popular and permanent items of American culture. In some ways, this wish has come true. Many of the pieces in slave songs remain familiar. Michael Row the Boat Ashore and Rock of My Soul in the Bosom of Abraham are commonly known. Other songs, such as The Good Old Way, experience a resurgence after a popular recording, such as Alison Krauss's Down to the River to Pray on the O Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack. The spirituals, as they were known by their original singers, became classical pieces famously sung by renowned artists like Marian Anderson. My professor James Cohn, in The Spirituals and the Blues, writes that though the white abolitionists recorded the spirituals on paper, it was the performances by the Fisk Jubilee singers that introduced them to a wider audience. They are forever rooted in the African-American tradition. They found a home in the ongoing struggle for civil rights, inspiring marchers and planners and leaders to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching on to freedom land, evolving to meet the specifics of the people's struggle for freedom and justice. If you listen to the first line of No More Auction Block, you might catch the beginning notes of We Shall Overcome. As sacred songs, the spirituals live on in hymnals and worship communities. Of the 30 spirituals included in the present-day Unitarian Universalist hymnals, 30, that's really astounding compared with other denominations, two hymns are spirituals from slave songs. Many Thousand Go is printed in Singing the Living Tradition as No More Auction Block for Me, which we just heard. The version in Slave Songs does not contain a verse about the auction block, which makes sense if the singers are looking forward to their impending freedom rather than a symbolic freedom that's already come. The verses reference the peck of corn and pint of salt, which were the rations they got during slavery, along with the driver's lash, hundred lash, and mistress call. The original singers were referencing the total disruption of their daily order. Later singers added the auction block verse, reflecting the systemic disruption of the end of slavery. Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Had is printed as Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen in Singing the Living Tradition. Alan heard Nobody Knows in Charleston. It spread to the Sea Islands and as far as Florida before the publication of Slave Songs, just 2 years after the war ended. There's some variation between the verses, and Slave Songs includes a Trouble I See alternate lyric already in 1867. Another variation is the presence or absence of the line Nobody Knows but Jesus. Our hymnal and many popular versions instead use the lyric, Nobody Knows My Sorrow. These variations testify to the living nature of the song. Previous Unitarian hymnals contain no spirituals whatsoever. So Unitarians cannot claim to preserve the works in unbroken succession, never mind the good start we had in beginning that work. The committee that produced Singing the Living Tradition had diversity in mind, and we benefit from it now. The hymnal is beautiful and contains many songs, readings, and prayers from diverse sources that inform our spirituality. And yet, we do not own these songs. We cannot own them. They are not a piece of Unitarian or Universalist tradition. I am not saying that Unitarian Universalist traditions and African American traditions are exclusive of one another. To do so would be to deny the existence and contribution of many Black Unitarian Universalists. I am saying that we should be aware of where we each individually sit in this particular Venn diagram of identity. I am a white Unitarian Universalist, and my mother sang spirituals to me as lullabies. I grew up singing spirituals. I love them. And they're about someone else, about men in Port Royal Sound, rowing a boat for their oppressors, about Emma Stewart, cold and starving, and mourning her baby daughter all alone. These songs are not part of my inheritance. But I can't help having a relationship with them. It's in me, in lullabies and church pews. It's in the work of Unitarians like William Francis Allen, Charles Picard Ware, and Thomas Wentworth Higginson. They did not try to promote the spirituals as their own. They used their privilege and connections to preserve and lift up the words of the formerly enslaved. They lifted up the words to prove that no person could be owned. So, what does this history have to do with us now? Three things. First, we have a relationship to the spirituals that requires us to hold them, care for them, keep them alive. The songs are not ours. The songs are their own. We need to sing them with purpose, but without claiming them, and always remember where they came from and to use them for justice. This might mean choosing not to sing the spirituals that imply the singer is enslaved. This might mean singing "We Shall Overcome" when the people of color leading the movement for Black lives ask us to. It might also mean not singing "We Shall Overcome" over top of a protest chant that makes us uncomfortable. Using these words, these songs, to silence those whose voices we mean to amplify is exploiting the songs and subverting justice. The second thing that this history has to teach us, we have an obligation to struggle for justice. It's in our history, the work of lifting up the words of others to be accomplices in our collective liberation. It's in our history to put ourselves at the service of those who enjoy less privilege in whatever way we can. Charlie Ware lived on St. Helena's for almost all of the Civil War, and Lucy McKim was only there for 1 month. The collectors were amateur musicians, but the work of these dedicated amateurs preserved a piece of the culture of the southern plantations before it was muddled too much by exposure to the northern missionaries. They leveraged their privilege, their place in society and literary spheres to proclaim that the formerly enslaved people had inherent worth and dignity. We have the obligation to put our skills, our privilege, our resources, our reputation on the line, and for those who are able, even our very selves, to support the movement for Black lives in whatever way we can. The third thing about this history, it's ongoing. The history of the struggle for racial justice in North America literally began with the presence of Europeans at the end of the 15th century. The first documented slave revolt in what would become the United States of America took place in San Miguel de Guadalupe, a Spanish colony, in 1526, 250 years before the American Revolution, never mind the Civil War. When we measure the gains in the struggle for racial justice against last year, 10 years ago, even 100 years ago, we only see a small piece of the story. And this history, too, is made of individuals, of Alicia Garza, Rosa Parks, Emma Stewart, Harriet Tubman, back and back to names we don't even know, without whom the struggle would not happen. Don't give up, because the history is long. Listen for the song of the oarsmen in Port Royal Sound. Tie in to that history and use it in your work for justice. Please join me in the spirit of prayer. Gracious Spirit of love and connection, we desire justice. Be with us as we struggle for justice. Teach us to find truth in relationship. Teach us to find neighbors in those we had thought others. We commemorate the lives of those lost to police violence and all who suffer oppression. We commemorate the lives lost in the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki 71 years ago. We honor the concerns of our individual hearts and our collective craving for more peace, more love, more justice. Teach us solidarity in our songs, words, and actions until all members of our human family are honored. May it be so.